magnetic resonance, particularly liquid state magnetic resonance and nuclear magnetic resonance, and thinking about how we could use that as a way of seeing the mapping between a physical system and a quantum information processor. We made the point that NMR wasn't going to be a quantum computer, at least the liquid state version of NMR wasn't going to be a quantum computer, but it would show us all the features of mapping to a quantum information processor, and in fact, it is the largest quantum information processor today, that we've done things with 13 quantum bits, which is by far more than other groups have. Still, we know why it doesn't scale, but given that we have this nice mapping, we can use it to investigate the methods and resources needed to achieve control over systems. And that's what the focus of that program is, to develop the methodology for showing that we have coherent control. So you remember that David DiVincenzo had his five rules. He says you need these five things to have a quantum computer. And the first you need is a scalable map. And that's a map from the physical system to qubits, to quantum bits. And of course, a quantum bit is a controllable two-level system. Okay, it need not physically be a two-level system. You might have a many-level system. You take two levels out of it, but somewhere you have two levels that you've taken as being your quantum bit. We need to be able to initialize. And by that, what we would like is to have some logical state, some fiducial state of many qubits that we could start off with the system. We'll see that. We need a complete set of gates. And that turns out to be really easy. I'll show you aspects of that. We need to control errors. And that is hard. And that's what kills almost every approach to quantum information processing. And we need a qubit specific measurement. That is pretty easy in most things. It's hard sometimes to get high visibility here, but it's assumed that with some engineering, everything can have that. Now we looked at NMR, and what we wrote down was that if we look at nuclear magnetic resonance, and we stretch ourselves to spin 1/2 systems, and a good example is a proton. Other examples are carbon 13, phosphorus 31, fluorine 19. There's a large number of spin 1/2 nuclei. But let's think about protons for a second. That the Hamiltonian has in its first piece the Zeeman interaction. And this is the quantizing interaction. And we're taking the magnetic field to be along the z-axis. Along the z-axis. Just by convention. So, we're breaking the symmetry of space. It doesn't matter how we break it. And that by saying that this is the quantization axis, this is defining the energy. And if it defines the energy, then it's most convenient to take the eigenbasis of sigma z as the eigenbasis of our system. Of course, you have complete flexibility there, but that's what we'll do. And so we'll say that we have the quantum states 0 and 1, and we'll map those onto spin up and spin down. And if we're mapping those onto that, we can associate, well, it's no longer an association, it's as we can look at these projectors of the spin state and rewrite those in terms of the Pauli matrices for our convenience. Yeah, and so we have a complete correspondence. So there's our physical map. And life is good. Now I'm going to jump down to Gates for a second. We saw that, well, let me say, for initialization, of course, what we want to do is to take our thermal state and map it onto to that fixed state. We did see here that the thermal state of the system, just again, given this Hamiltonian, it's all we need. So that rho equilibrium was equal to the identity minus about 10 to the minus 5 sigma z. And this 10 to the minus 5, remember, is the energy of the system, omega naught, divided by kT. And if I put in the units of a field of about 10 tesla and at room temperature, then we'll see that h bar times a few hundred megahertz divided by kT is about 10 to the minus 5. So the system is very highly mixed. It is very close to being in the identity state. But that's okay. It's a fairly sensitive measurement. And we can see this deviation part of the density matrix. And because the population is so low, what we're going to do is to observe an ensemble of spins. And so the typical sample has about 10 to the 14 spins in it. All right, so we make up for this by having many, 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 many copies of the system. Then we said that we wanted to have controls. So to have control, we're going to add to the Hamiltonian an RF piece of the Hamiltonian. The RF part of the Hamiltonian looks like, I'll write it out completely first. It has some frequency that we're modulating the system at, some amplitude of the radio frequency field. The fundamental Hamiltonian is along the x-axis, and the Hermitian conjugates of this, of course. And here, where we have this modulation, that's useful to go into an interaction frame of that. And if I combine these two Hamiltonians into a total Hamiltonian, go into the interaction frame, make the rotating wave approximation, then we can say that H tilde, let's call it H effective, I like that better actually. H effective in that rotating frame is delta omega over 2 sigma z, where delta omega is equal to omega naught minus omega t, okay, plus omega 1 over 2 sigma x. And so it has a very simple form in this that we have here our control process, here the quantization axis, okay, but shifted because we're in this rotating frame. And I want to make it clear that this quantity is a function of time. Let me give us a little bit more space there. So that the way we're going to control the system is by turning on and off this Hamiltonian by changing the amplitude. You have a question?
Yeah, I was just the radio frequency that itself is a Hermitian.
Yes.
So what we are adding here is actually 1 bit minus the signs, so that it represents a left moving and a right moving.
In this case, it's just a right hand rotating. So I should have written it down. So that's what I meant by the Hermitian function. The often you'll see that we relate this term back to the physically relevant term, which says that we have an oscillating current in a coil leading to an oscillating field, and then we decompose the oscillating field into left and right handed rotating fields. Here I just wrote down the rotating field. So in fact, when we go to the rotating frame, we don't even have to make the rotating frame approximation. There is no other field to draw. Yeah. Now we also saw. Yeah.
What was omega 1?
Omega 1 is the amplitude of the radio frequency field.
I thought that was T. Sorry.
So it's omega 1 of T. Yeah.
Got it.
So this is set by an amplifier. And this is set by a synthesizer. We also had to define two relaxation times. We define a relaxation time T1, which is the energy relaxation time given these two quantum bits. So it's the exchange of energy between the system in some lattice that takes us back to thermal equilibrium. And we call it the spin lattice relaxation time for that reason. And there was a time constant T2, which is the spin-spin relaxation time, which doesn't require any exchange of energy, which only requires that the measures the coherence time of the spins as we allow the spins to process. Okay? We can combine all these and block combine them all into so-called block equations. And what Bloch showed is that there's an isomorphism between these dynamics in SU2 and the dynamics in SO3. And then he wrote down a set of expressions to describe the measurement, the evolution of the expectation values of the Pauli operators. And remember that since we're looking at an ensemble of 10 to 17 copies of this, that the expectation values are going to be, we'll sample the expectation values very precisely. Okay, so Bloch's equations are, I think, most clearly written out in terms of differential equations of the time rate of change of the elements of the magnetization. Remembering that if I take any of these elements of the magnetization, mx, say, then that's proportional to the expectation value of sigma x. Okay? So, but here we wanted to make it quite clear that we're talking about a macroscopic magnetization. So the first piece that you have of the Bloch equations is this piece here, this effective Hamiltonian with an off-resonance term. And so we can add that in. And of course, what that term does is it introduces a precession about the z-axis. And so we'll have, and I always have to think about this a little bit. So so we have a precession term that is going to carry x into y and y into minus x. So this is a piece that is a rotation delta omega sigma z about the z-axis. There's going to be these relaxation terms. Let me add those on next that say that the x and y components of the magnetization will decay to zero. Remember that the equilibrium state is polarized solely along the z-axis, that there's no energy associated with the XY magnetization. So the final state needs to be zero. And the rate that that law says is T2. And of course, it's a cylindrically symmetric system. So there can be no difference between X and Y in that case. The Z component relaxes by as T1. But it relaxes back to thermal equilibrium. So we can assign a value for the equilibrium magnetization. It's just called M sub Z. And as I mentioned last time, that is just the Curie magnetization of the system. All right, so these are the relaxation terms.
You said that's the Curie
magnetization? Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's the equilibrium magnetization, but it's also just the Curie magnetization. The equilibrium magnetization and the Curie magnetization is. Okay, then finally we have this piece here, which is a time-dependent mutation. And if we write down a coordinate system, and we'll put X and Y in the rotating frame. So if I thought about the Hamiltonian of the system, then we would say that we have some Hamiltonian delta omega along the z-axis. And the radio frequency field here, we've written it to appear along the x prime axis. But we could have that appear anywhere in the transverse plane. So it could appear on the y prime axis, or it could appear anywhere in between them. Anywhere in the xy plane, we can apply the radio frequency field. It corresponds to a phase shift of the synthesis. All I need to do is adjust the phase at this point. Okay. But we'll write it down along x, and it's easy enough to generalize. So if we have the mutation field which is omega 1 sigma x, and that's a time, I'll just call it omega 1. Then when that value omega 1 is not zero, it's going to mix y and z. And again, I have to think about this. So this will be plus omega 1 sigma z and minus omega 1 m sub y.
Yeah.
And so now we have a complete description of the spin dynamics of the spin 1/2 particle. And this complete description is true for any two-level system. Okay, so any two-level system, you can always use a Planck equation to describe their dynamics. Okay. We looked at last class a Rabi experiment. Remember what the Rabi experiment was? It was to apply RF for some period of time. And then we're going to describe that by an angle theta, say it's along the x-axis. And we have some amplitude and some time. Typically, we'll vary the time of the pulse, but we can vary the amplitude of the pulse. But the important part is the action of the pulse, the angle. And of course, we saw that if we start at thermal equilibrium, thermal equilibrium is proportional to sigma z now. So what I've done is to take the deviation part of the density matrix and to drop the identity, because there's nothing that we're going to be able to do to that identity. In this case, we only have weak measurements, so there's no way I can take the identity with a series of unitary propagators and do anything to it other than leave it as the identity. And so we'll simply suppress it for now. We'll come back to it, we'll be important. But right now, I'm just going to suppress it because I'm looking at the dynamics. And so we apply our Planck equations, and at this point, I'm going to make everything easy by taking delta omega is equal to 0. so that the mutation pulse is exactly along the x-axis. And when you do that, then applying an x pulse, we get rho as a function of theta is equal to sigma t cosine theta minus sigma 1 sine. And so we're just rotating it as we'd expect. By that. And it is the very first experiment anyone does with a qubit is to demonstrate that you can have Rabi, so-called Rabi flops. So to show M sub z as a function of theta, and to count how many cycles you can have before the system decays away. And this relates back to our question of gates. Here, the Rabi flops are telling us that we have a one qubit gate, that we can take our system in a fiducial state, and we can put it into a coherent superposition state. Okay, so that's the very first thing that's required of any quantum processor. And there's a rough figure of merit there, you would think, that if I measure this decay rate, so we'll say that this thing goes approximately like e to the minus, this is also time, divided by t Rabi. So we can say that perhaps that decay is exponential. We often model it as an exponential. It very rarely is precisely exponential. And if I said that the frequency here is omega 1, right? So the period is 2 pi over omega 1. Then I could say the figure of merit is omega 1 t Rabi. And I should like that to be much, much greater than 1 if I have control over the system. The next experiment is to look at the Ramsey fringe. An experiment looks like this. So you excite the system into a coherent superposition, and you allow it to evolve. Okay. So if we again start off with the equilibrium density matrix equal to sigma z, we apply a pi over 2 rotation about the x pulse. That pi over 2 rotation, just looking here, it's exactly the same thing, leaves us in minus sigma y. So we've created a coherent superposition state. And at this point, we turn off omega 1, right? If omega 1 is only on for that brief period of time, we turn off omega 1. So these terms vanish. We solve the Planck equations, and we see that here, rho as a function of time is going to be minus cosine delta omega t e to the minus t over t2 sigma y. So here I happen to assume that delta omega is 0. I did during the pulse, just to save us a little bit of algebra. Plus sine delta omega t e to the minus t over t2 sigma x. Plus the return to equilibrium, right? This term, this term is 0. There's no precession terms because the precession terms are rotation about z, but there is a return to thermal equilibrium. So we have plus 1 minus e to the minus t over t1 sigma z. And properly, I should multiply everything by m sub 0. But I dropped it here, so I'm just going to set m sub 0 equal to 1 in this case. And then everything is correctly in the units. Yeah? So now if we plotted these terms, well, then we would have for m sub x an oscillation. Again, this frequency is 2 pi over delta omega. The envelope of this is e to the minus t over t2. The y component of the magnetization is exactly out of phase, and in this case starts off negative because of the what we chose to have the phase of this pulse that we chose this to be x. And okay, I will try to draw it. It will decay with exactly the same time constant. It has exactly the same frequency. All of that is straightforward. And then there's, didn't leave myself enough space, but I'm going to try it here anyways. There's a growth of the z in this. The magnetization along z will grow, but it grows with a different time constant. It grows with the time constant t1, where t1 is greater than or equal to t2. And remember, last class we wrote down the Krauss operators for the jump process, and we showed that in the symmetric case, in the case where there's noise about x and y, that t1 has to be longer than or equal to t2. In the case where there isn't that symmetry, where there's only noise along the x-axis, for instance, then t2 can be twice t1. Okay? So now we have a very simple piece of the dynamics. And the last thing that to just keep us all on the same page is to remember that in NMR, we measure the x and y components of the magnetization. Remember that we had a small coil surrounded near our samples, and that coil had a field directed along the x direction. That was, in fact, this term here. And that we use the same coil for excitation and detection. And so what we, when we measure that, I put it here, we measure an induced EMF over the coil. Which is the overlap of the magnetization and the field produced by that coil, normalized by the field of the coil, okay, and integrated over all space. And of course, it's an EMF, so we better take the time rate of change, right? Because the EMF is the magnetization cutting the flux lines of the field in that coil. And so here, we would measure these two components, the x and y component. And if we took a Fourier transform of that, you will remember that if I take a Fourier transform of this piece right here, that the Fourier transform of, and let's be a little bit careful here. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take the signal as a complex unit. So the signal as a function of time is going to be sigma x of t plus I sigma y of t. Yeah, let's just write it as a complex number. I think it's rotating in a plane, so it's an obvious thing to do. And it allows me to write down the Fourier transform easily, because now I can take cosine omega t and sine omega t, and I can combine them into e to the I omega t, in this case with a 90 degree phase shift, right, to multiply by I. The Fourier transform, so we'll take the signal and we'll say that it looks like e to the I delta omega t, e to the I is a phase shift, e to the minus t over t2. Okay, that's a whole term right there. A phase shift just stays a phase shift. There's no time dependence. We're taking the Fourier transform with respect to time. This term transforms into a delta function. Should remember that, I hope. This is just a phase term. And this transforms into a Lorentzian line shift. And so if we plotted this, we would have a Lorentzian centered at delta omega. And the width of that Lorentzian is 1 over pi 2, 2. OK. Now you can see another element of our control. That if I have multiple spin-1 half particles, they can have different values of delta omega. If I want them to be controllable, that variation in delta omega better be bigger than 1 over pi times t2. So there's a resolved spectral difference between them. And that's a challenge in qubits, of finding a way to have enough resolution that we can independently address all the qubits. Good. Now, notice two things here. Any questions on any of this? No. Okay. Notice two things here. One, by making this particular measurement, we learn about delta omega, we learn about T2, but we don't learn about T1. We also learn indirectly about omega 1 because the overall response depended upon the time of that pulse. But there's nothing in this result that allows us to tell what T1 is, because T1 governs the dynamics along the z-axis, and we're detecting along the x-y plane. So we have to find a way of measuring T1. The second thing is that not all spectroscopy measures the x and y components, since particularly if we're looking at flux qubits or we're looking at optical systems, we need to add a second pulse here, pi over 2 minus x, and to detect along z at that point. So we need to rotate one component of this back up into the xy plane and then sample. And you can see that that leads to a challenge in measuring a process. If you can detect the expectation value along x and y, we can detect those continuously. And so we can record this line fit in one step. If you have to stop each time, rotate the spins or the qubit back along the energy axis and then take a measurement, then if I want 1,000 data points, I need you to have 1,000 averages. If for each average I need 10 to the 6 samples to get a good statistics, okay, then I need 10 to the 9 experiments. And then you have to have a factor of 2 because you want both the x and y components. And now it's made into a very, very long experiment. And typically, we do have to carry out those very long experiments. That's what happens. But in magnetic resonance, we don't. But in flux qubits and in optically detected magnetic resonance, then you have to go through all that. OK. Now, we need to find a way of measuring this T1 process. There are a number of approaches to do that. You can see it pretty much right here, that if I wanted to measure the T1 of this, well, the T1 is certainly coded in this over time. You know, the problem of making a measurement is that we are not sensitive to what happens along the z-axis. And so we can do exactly what our colleagues did for the Ramsey experiment, and we can rotate the z-axis into the xy plane and sample it. And if you're going to do that, then it's not the most convenient experiment to create a coherence. Because all you're looking, all you want to see is what happens to the z components of the magnetization. So you might as well put as much magnetization along z, make that modulation as big as possible. So to measure the T1, it's almost always that we use an inversion recovery experiment, and where we rotate the spins by pi, wait for some time, and then rotate them into the xy axis. So here, again, we start off rho equilibrium along sigma z. During this time, following the pulse, the magnetization's along minus y. During this time t, minus y, minus z, thank you. We've rotated the spins all the way to the minus z axis. And with them along the minus z axis, of course, they're going to relax towards equilibrium. So during this time, we will have the rho sub t is equal to 1 minus 2 e to the minus t over t1. And so it'll relax back to equilibrium. Of course, it has to go through 0 to see that. And so if we plot this out, we'll get our decay going through 0. And of course, it goes through 0 at t1 log 2. We still need to rotate it back into the xy plane to detect. And so this is, of course, along z. And there's nothing. X and y are 0 because we didn't put any magnetization in the xy. It just simply relaxes back along the z-axis, given this part of Bloch's equations. And then by giving this pulse, we see minus sigma y. And there's a negative sign there. And let me call that sigma z, just to be consistent. You had a question, Chris?
You answered it in the course.
OK. Good. All right. So there's the inversion recovery, and that's an important piece of what everyone studies. That if you can, with the inversion recovery sequence, we can measure this with just the Ramsey fringe. We can measure this. And here, we can measure omega 1 with the Ravi frequency. If you can see coherence in all of that, and you have a reasonable lifetime, then you're justifying saying you have a quantum bit. And just there, you have your first quantum bit. Okay, let's talk a little bit more about the Hamiltonians of the system. And then we'll look a little bit more at control. So we've got one quantum bit, but there's very little interesting you can do with one quantum bit. In fact, Bloch's equation says that there's nothing interesting you can do with one quantum bit. You have one quantum bit, then you have this nice isomorphism to SO3, and that's it. You know, there's nothing you're going to do to demonstrate easily that you have a quantum processor, unless you look at strong measurements. And in the files that I gave you, I show you some dynamics with that. But now let's look at something beyond one quantum bit. So if I have beyond one quantum bit, I need to add some terms to the Hamiltonian. We need to add two terms. So our Hamiltonian still has the term delta omega sigma z. But now I'm going to sum over the quantum bits, because I want to show that I have more than one. So every spin has this term in it. Plus, we have a term that is a slight change in the resonance frequency. In this piece here, this so-called chemical shift, is a small perturbation. It's about 10 to the minus 6 of omega naught. So we typically describe it in terms of parts per million. And it's related to screening of the electrons. So of course, here we're talking about a magnetic moment, a nuclear magnetic moment, so a magnetic moment in the nuclei. And surrounding the nuclei is the electronic cloud from whatever structure of a molecule we have. That electronic cloud is going to just partially shield the nuclei from the applied magnetic field. You think about it just like Lenz's law. So you have a screening of the nuclei from the magnetic field. And that screening depends upon the structure of the cloud. So if I have chemically distinct nuclei, then those chemically distinct nuclei have chemically distinct electron clouds. And we can see that difference. So if I have a nice simple molecule, dibromothiophene, which has two protons, and they look like they're in very similar environments. But they're enough different that these two resonance frequencies are very cleanly resolved from each other. And so we get nice sharp lines for each of those protons. Okay, and the difference is simply this chemical shift term. Yeah?
So the I is the index which is measuring our different qubits, right?
That's right.
So in this case, if you're doing number one,
right, so we'll just label them 1 and 2. Okay. Now, the chemical shift is dependent upon the orientation of the molecule. So as the molecule tumbles, of course, this electron cloud tumbles. And the screening of the nucleus depends upon that orientation. Okay, so this term leads to a fluctuating field. Now, what we're measuring here is just the average over all possible fluctuations. And that average is not zero. Okay, so it's the isotropic part of the shielding tensor that we report here. As a molecule tumbles, the tumbling is very fast. And we're making measurements on a very slow time scale. We're making measurements on a time scale of T2, which is of order seconds. And so within a second, a molecule has sampled all possible orientations very effectively. And so we only measure, in this case, the isotropic average of that. The fact that it is modulated by the tumbling of the molecule is important for relaxation. And we'll see that in the lecture, that as this, as a molecule tumbles, we have a fluctuating field. That fluctuating field can lead to transitions, and we'll see how that comes in. For now, we know that it tumbles. We know there's a fluctuating field, but we're only interested in isotropic average, and we're only interested because it's different for each atom. Okay. Now, this isn't enough, right? This says that I could have two individual qubits, but we want something more than that. If we have universal control, we need the qubits to be able to talk to each other. So I need to have a bilinear interaction for the qubits to talk to each other. And in magnetic resonance, there are two bilinear interactions. The first one is a so-called scalar coupling constant. And for ridiculous reasons, well, it's not so ridiculous, this is always given in terms of a frequency unit, not an angular velocity. And the reason is that J is field independent. So that as I change the static magnetic field, remember that delta omega is equal to gamma B0, so it's proportional to the magnetic field. This term is proportional to the magnetic field. This term is independent of magnetic field. So here we have a scalar coupling. And the scalar coupling is a contact term. What happens is the nuclear spin polarizes the overlapping electron spin. The electron spin, of course, is in some molecular orbital, and it overlaps another nuclear spin. And therefore, it indirectly, one nuclear spin polarizes the other nuclear spin. You can see that if I have the scalar coupling term, it requires a Fermi contact term. It requires overlap. The only electrons that overlap the nucleus are S electrons. And so you can, in fact, calculate the scalar coupling quite well from the molecular orbitals. And those systems that have those bonds, molecular orbitals that have high S character, have strong couplings. So as I go from a single bond to a double bond to a triple bond, the coupling, effective coupling constant becomes larger. You remember from your hybridization models of molecular orbitals. Okay, so now we have a bilinear term here, and we can control the system. This bilinear term, which is a sigma dot sigma term, is often approximated as sigma z, sigma z. And there's some simple justification for that. But let me rewrite that Hamiltonian. So I'm going to rewrite the Hamiltonian as having a sum of a term. I'm just going to write it for two spins, and that will be enough. Let's write it like that. And the reason I want to write it like that is that sigma x, well, let me not skip any steps here. If I take and expand out the dot product of the two polys, of course, this is the sum. Three components. Yeah? Now, clearly, this term commutes with everything else in the Hamiltonian. Right? And remember, of course, that any operator, let me write that down. any operator on two different spins, any two operators on two different spins always commutes, right? Because the spins are distinct. So that's you always have. All right. So clearly, this term commutes with that. If I look at, and it's easy enough to show, that if I take any term xx or yy, or zz, of course, it always commutes with the sum of two operators. Okay. But sigma z1 minus sigma z2 does not commute with either xx or yy. So these things, so that's always equal to 0. This is not equal to 0. So now then I have to have two limits of this. I want to look at not this term, because that term comes along for the ride. It always commutes. That's easy. I want to look at these two. And there's the case where this term's bigger, and there's the case where that term's bigger. Okay? If this term is bigger, then what matters is not what interacts with this. What matters is this term itself. And now I need to keep all of the terms. Okay? If this term is bigger, then these two pieces don't commute. They become non-secular, and they don't influence the dynamics of the system. Okay? So in the weak coupling limit, where J is less than delta than omega minus, as I've written it there, then Hj is approximately sigma z1 times sigma z2. And I give you a Mathematica notebook to allow you to see exactly what happens in the case where you have strong coupling as well. So I only have 5 minutes. Look at the notebook. Let me just leave it like that for a second. And let's continue down with this term, because this really relates to what's going on. So here we say, okay, fine. I'm going to modify this to have sigma z, ij, no dot. Now then, I want to see that I can have a conditional rotation based upon this bilinear term, that I can rotate spin 1 conditionally on spin 2, given that term. If you can do that, then you have universal control. So I'm going to apply a pi over 2 pulse along the x-axis to both spins 1 and spin 2. And for now, I'm just going to draw what happens. Let's just draw it. I'm going to make it even simpler. I'm just going to rotate spin 1. So we start with spin 1 along the z-axis. So that's the initial state. Of spin 1. We apply a rotation about the x-axis. I'll put the x-axis there. Then the spins will come down, and they will be aligned along the minus y direction. Then I'm going to wait for some time. I'm going to take the delta omega for spin 1 to be 0. Okay? So that if there was no coupling, the spin would sit right here along y. Okay, but there's a scalar coupling. What does the scalar coupling say? We have a term that says sigma z1 times sigma z2 with j in front of it. It says, hey, it's going to rotate about the z-axis, right? That's the Hamiltonian. So it says that spin 1 will rotate
about Z, but conditionally on the magnetic quantum number for spin 2. So if spin 2 is in the plus mz plus 1/2 state, it will rotate one way. So it's going to rotate in this direction if the spin, if spin 2 is up. That's spin 2. It's going to rotate in the other direction if spin 2 is down. OK, so now the two vectors are rotating in opposite directions. And if I wait for a total of 1 over 2j, then at that moment, they will have each rotated by pi over 2. And so they'll be in this anti-aligned state. So this is the spin 1 vectors. This is spin 1 vector with spin 2 being up. And that's the spin 1 vector with spin 2 being down. And now we see that we've gotten this conditional rotation. I would like to show the so-called control not gate. Remember that from the neutron interferometry? The control not gate said, rotate qubit 1 by pi conditionally on the state of spin 2. Well, that's easy, because now I'm going to rotate this back to pi. So I'm going to give it, this is the minus y axis. So I'm going to give it to pi over 2 rotation of that minus y. And now then, we end up with this anti-line state that says, hey, spin 1 is up. If spin 2 is up, it's down. If spin 2 is down. And we've implemented a control not gate. So now we have universal control over 2 qubits. Now, there's two things to note. One, this is not correctly, this is not a control knot with all the correct phases as you would write down. So if I write down the propagator of a control knot, have that state for the propagator of a control knot, you would see if you write down the propagator for these rotations, which you can easily do, go ahead and do it, you'll get additional phases. We can remove those additional phases. We have universal control. But this is simple to see. And you know, let's start with something simple. The other place, way you can see this is to say, hey, I've got 3 Hamiltonians. I have the Hamiltonian sigma z1, sigma z2. That's one term of my Hamiltonian. I have the rotation of the nutation angle, which is sigma x1 identity plus identity sigma x2. Right? That's the second piece of my sets of Hamiltonians. And I have the difference in the chemical shifts. So I have a third Hamiltonian that is sigma z1 identity 2 minus identity 1 sigma z2. And if you take those 3 generators, then you can show that you can generate the full algebra of SU4 from these. You can show that by simply taking the commutators of those and looking at all the nested commutators until you've generated all 16 operators in SU4. An easier way of doing it is to say, hey, here, clearly, I have all the generators in SU2, right? Because the commutator gives me SY. Then all I need to do is worry about the bilinear terms. If I take this operator applied to there, I can create YY. Yeah? If I allow this term to act on YY, I can rotate to YX or minus YY. I can do anything with this term acting on sigma y, and so then I can apply this one again and get any operator I want. So it's very easy to show that you can build up all of the bilinear terms. You build up all the bilinear terms, you have all the SU2, you have everything. So we have of scalable math. We have gates. We certainly have a qubit-specific measurement. We still need to control errors, and we still need to initialize. And we'll do both of those next class. Yes?
What brought you into the word time here? There's no string through lecture on 10 today, so.
Oh. Life is very easy then.
We've just been announced that there's no string through lecture on 10 today.
Okay. All right.
Apparently, his flight was canceled for you.
Yeah, something like that.
Good. Okay. So go ahead and do that problem. And let me spend a few minutes talking about initialization. But before I do, is there any questions with this? Now, it's very tempting. Okay, go ahead.
So this is then always going off, right? This is not controlled by some pulse we put in.
Well, this is controlled by a pulse we put in. Right? So this term in the Hamiltonian is time dependent, where
right.
We put in the time dependence.
But I mean this controlled knot process that we
no?
talked about here, we've got that J, sigma Z1, sigma Z2, and that's not.
So let me try to answer your question. No, I'm going to. Here we have a pulse, a delay, and another pulse. Pi over 2, 1. And if I want to get the phases right, I would have to have a delay and another pulse, and then we get the phases right. And you can show that very, very simply. So here, the effective Hamiltonian that we have at any instant in time always includes this term. But if I ask, well, what's the effective Hamiltonian for this full thing, right? Then that's the log of this operator.
Right.
Now, there is some really bad science that says, oh, you can't do quantum computing if you have your Hamiltonians on all the time. It is absolutely bullshit. It costs you no resources to turn them off.
Right.
Okay, and you know it is very simple to show. So don't get stuck with these bad ideas.
Hausmann showed that we could turn off potentials like that.
Right.
He did walk through that derivation. I was just trying to make sure that this was one of those potentials we did have to turn off.
Yes.
Okay.
But okay. Let me. Let me save the plenix for another day. But there's issues. The issues we care about in quantum computing are scaling issues. And to say in any process that I need to include one more pulse, you know, that's not the scaling issue. It doesn't change any of the dynamics. And it turns out that the reason we're able to do 13 qubits is that this is bloody reproducible. That if I take that molecule and I pulse it today and I come back tomorrow, it is exactly the same. I never have to, in these controlled potentials, there we have to worry about the fluctuations. I'm going to show you how to deal with fluctuations. But, you know, anyways. Okay, other comments? Good. So let me take this. And let's talk about initialization. So now I have two qubits. So now I can say, yeah, I've got two qubits. And the equilibrium density matrix for those two qubits is going to be the identity minus, let's write it out, it's going to look like that. Now we've mapped qubits into, and I've erased it. We've mapped spins in the qubits, and we said that if we have the spin in the zero state, that is 1/2 identity plus sigma z, and if spin is in the one state, that's 1/2 identity minus sigma z. And so if I have two spins that are polarized, so if I want to prepare spins in the ground state where they're both polarized, I should have 1/4 identity 1 plus sigma z1 Kronecker identity 2 plus sigma z2 equal to 1/4 the identity plus I should have that operator. Yeah. And you can see that if I say, okay, what's the process that takes me from there to there? There is no unitary process that takes you from there to there. Right? The eigenvalues are different in those two, for those two operators. So there's nothing we can do unitarily. That will take us from one to the other. Further, we have the challenge that because we don't have strong measurement, there's nothing I can do with this, absolutely. So this remains. And here, it would be very nice to think you have strong measurement. You have strong measurement. You say, okay, I'll go in and measure spin one. I'll take spin one, and if I find out it's in the upstate, I'll rotate it down, etc. Now, of course, we're measuring 10 to the 17. And so I measure 10 to the 17 spin, and I find out that of those 10 to the 17, 10 to the 2 times 10 to the 16 plus 10 to the 12 are pointed up. But it doesn't tell you which one's the split. There's a switch, right? It just says that on average you have that population. So there's nothing we can do here. So what we want to do is to apply a non-unitary process that will take this piece here to a scaled version of this piece. And here I have to multiply this by a scaling constant. And then I can create a system which is isomorphic to a pure state, so that the deviation parts of the density matrix will transform as though they were a pure state. All right, so that's what the isomorphism is. We'll create a state that is that the deviation part Now, if I'm going to do that, I can't, I still have to do this through a set of unitary processes. Right? That's what we have control over. So what we're going to do is to run a set of unitaries that we're going to then take the average over. And now I have an ensemble of 10 to 17 molecules. So one way of doing that would be to say, fine, I'll take half the ensemble and do this, and a quarter of the ensemble and do that, and a quarter of the ensemble and do that, and then I'll average that dynamic. The other thing you could do is you could say, the first time I look at this system, I will do this. And the second time, I'll do this. And the third time, I'll do this, and I'll average over the results. Right? But there's this averaging of unitaries that's going to allow us to implement what is an apparently non-unitary process. Clearly, it won't really be non-unitary
because we've labeled the system. We've said that, hey, in this part of the ensemble, I've done this. So there's a labeling. And it only appears non-unitary if I ignore that labeling. So now we have a system that is sigma z I plus I sigma z. We want to transform it into something that looks like this. Okay. So here, what we're going to do is to apply a theta rotation by the first pulse, and let's just apply it around the x-axis, the first step. So we're going to apply a theta rotation to the first step. And of course, this theta rotation is going to take and leave some piece of that state along z. It's going to put the other piece in it along y. And since it's a rotation about the first spin, it's going to do nothing to the identity. It'll do nothing to the second spin. So this term just comes along for the ride.
Yeah.
Now I need to create this bilinear term here. And the only way we can create that bilinear term is to allow the system to evolve under the scalar coupling. So we allow it to evolve for some time. And during this time, we have the scalar coupling Hamiltonian acting. Well, of course, it commutes with the first term. So the first term, again, just goes along for the ride. The second term gets transformed. So there will be a term that looks like minus sine theta cosine, and let me assign an angle here. It's called phi. It is easy to show, and you should do this, that if I take sigma y1 tensor identity and apply an operator sigma z, then it evolves into sigma x1 sigma z2. You would show that by calculating the commutator, right? The time rate of change is just the commutator. So all I need to do is to take the commutator of those two and put that term.
Yeah?
So it evolves into that. Okay, and then finally, again, sigma z commutes with this piece. So we're left with that term. Now, here I have sigma x sigma z. I want to have a term that's a sigma z, sigma z. I'm going to rotate this again. I'm going to rotate it about the y-axis. So I rotate sigma x into z. So I'm going to rotate this by some angle alpha for this first spin about the y-axis. Now, if I rotate this about the y-axis, you know, we have to rotate everything. So, okay, forgive me for having lots of terms here. But we'll have cosine theta, cosine alpha, sigma z1. There'll be a term that is rotated into x. The y pulse is going to rotate us into x. So there'll be a term that is cosine theta sine alpha sigma y1. So that's those two terms. Here, sigma y, of course, commutes with the y rotation.
So this term simply stays. This term, both of these, only this one's going to rotate, thank goodness. So we'll have a term that looks like sine theta, sine phi, cosine alpha, sigma x1, sigma z2, and I'm going to have a term that is plus sine theta, sine phi, sine alpha, sigma z1, sigma z2. And this term isn't changed. And now we're just about there. What I'm going to do is, at this point, all these rotations have been applied uniformly to the whole sample. And now I'm going to introduce a Hamiltonian that's going to treat different parts of the sample differently. And the simplest Hamiltonian for this, yeah?
You have sigma y1 twice there, is that? What would second and third terms? Are those both?
So this, oh yeah. Hold on, no. That's sigma x. Yeah, sorry. Z rotates into X. Yeah.
Do you need to put a density in the second system the first term cos theta sigma Z1 identity 2?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, every place there's identities on the second spin. Yeah, absolutely. But I won't write them in, but absolutely they should be there. And, you know, just to be consistent, I'll erase that one. Okay, so now we have a Hamiltonian. I'm going to make the Hamiltonian to be a variation in the magnetic field strength. Okay. So the way I think about this is, of course, we have the gyromagnetic ratio, but here we have a magnetic field gradient. So I have a magnetic field that's increasing over the sample. And if it's increasing over the sample, the amplitude of it, the precession rate depends upon its location, and it rotates all the spins the same way. It doesn't distinguish between spins. Every spin in a plane gets rotated by the same angle. In the next plane, they get rotated by the same but different angle, etc. Okay? And the nice thing about this is I can make it time dependent. So I can turn this on and off, and I can even vary the strength of it. So here I can say, oh yeah, for some brief period of time, let me introduce what will look like a dephasing mechanism. Let me introduce a random rotation about z. It'll be random because I'm going to integrate over the sample. And you can see, if I do that, this term stays. It commutes with that. This term goes to zero because I'm going to take this term sigma x. Let's just write that out. Under that Hamiltonian, we take sigma x, and it's going to go to cosine of gamma dbz dz z times whatever time we applied it to sigma x, and then there'll be a term sine minus gamma plus dbz dz z t sigma y. And if I average all those, take the average of this over z, and if I make z big enough, this thing goes approximately to zero. And what's the approximation? It's the width. So it goes, you know, the bigger I make z,
1 over that width, it goes to 0 within that confines. So this term goes to 0. By exactly the same argument, this term goes to 0. By exactly the same argument, this term goes to 0. You know, it's a bilinear term, but it goes as, it's rotating each of the spins. So it'll rotate sigma x, but it won't rotate sigma z. So this term goes to 0. And so now we're left with this term that we wanted, this term that we wanted, and this term that we wanted. And we have one more step. One, we should choose alpha, theta phi, and alpha, so that these two terms are the same. Those two factors are the same. And that's easy enough to do. And then this term, which is showing up with amplitude 1, well, that's relatively simple. I'm going to rotate it by some angle beta about the sigma x-axis. So if I rotate this one by some angle beta, I can leave a little piece of it in the z-axis. And all I need to do is to take cosine beta to equal this, to equal that. And now I've prepared a pseudo-pure state. And I've done it by taking this deviation part of the density matrix and mapping it into this term. Okay? So we can make this isomorphism. And then we can have a state that we can explore information processing on. What's the problem? The problem is that as we do this, let's say I have three spins here, then this prefactor is going to be 1 over 2 to the 3. And in general, that prefactor is 1 over 2 to the n. And so I take a fixed amount of magnetization here. This prefactor doesn't change. This is a constant, regardless of the number of spins I have. So I take a fixed amount of magnetization, and I have to partition it between exponentially many terms. And so the efficiency of mapping this deviation part of the density matrix into what looks like a shifted pure density matrix is exponentially inefficient. And so the fact that we could do it for 13 spins says that we have a lot of signals to noise, because 2 to the 13 isn't a small number. But, you know, every time you can do it, it's one of those cases where it's very easy to sit for someone to say, fine, I accept your value. Now, you know, let's just add one more qubit and give you a hit by a factor of 2. And then you can't take that many hits by factors of 2. So very quickly you run out of steam. And that. Okay, so this gives us a way to initialize. It gives us a way of initializing to study the dynamics of a quantum information processing. It doesn't give us a way of initializing to have a scalable quantum computer. But we have that. And so the next time what we'll talk about is how do we control the errors. Okay? So.